It's called the Alaskan Highway. It was completed in 1942, and it links the main bulk of the United States through Canada to Alaska. And while it is very different now, there was a time when to drive the Alaskan Highway was quite a challenge. So much so that partway along the Alaskan Highway, there was a big sign that says, "Choose your rut with care. You will be in it for the next 150 miles. I wonder what rut we've chosen with care. What rut we're currently traveling along. And what will it take to disrupt us? Throws up another question. When disruption finds us, when we are going along, seemingly everything working fine, and suddenly something crops up and it disrupts us, where is Jesus in a time of disruption? It's an interesting question, because this short passage, this just a few verses in John's Gospel, in John chapter 10, we find a conversation between Jesus and the people who John calls the Jews, or in other words, the people who are known as the people of God. We find a conversation where everywhere you look is disruption. Everywhere we turn in these few verses, from the backdrop to the setting to the conversation itself, this short passage highlights disruption. Put this in some sort of context. Verses 22 to 30 come in the middle of John chapter 10, which up until now has been a discussion about spiritual leadership, the role of shepherd as a metaphor for spiritual guidance and pastoral care. As part of that conversation that leads up to this, Jesus has said, "I am the good shepherd." Now, that always sounds a very sort of innocuous, warm, fuzzy statement. But said in the context of the conversation with Israel, it's anything but a comforting statement. It's a disruptive statement. It's disruptive because by saying, "I am the good shepherd," everybody knows that Jesus is referring back to Ezekiel 34, which, if you've read it, is a scathing account, a scathing comment on the lack of pastoral care from Israel's leaders. And there's an echo of Ezekiel 34 hanging in the background of this conversation. It hangs as a shadow over the conversation in verses 22 to 30. It's one of those moments when everybody knows what's being said and nobody has the courage to say it directly. And yet suddenly, Jesus says it. Ever been in one of those conversations? Somebody says something and you know what's being said, and up until now, no one's had the courage to say it. Jesus knows exactly what he's saying. And so does everybody else. Ezekiel 34 is not a pleasant read. Certainly if you're a pastor, it's not a pleasant read. And it's not a pleasant read because it highlights the failures of pastoral charge over God's people. But John's original audience would know exactly what this says. But it doesn't end there. It doesn't end with the run-up to these verses, because the emphasis, to emphasize the point, John describes the conversation that Jesus has with these people as taking place in the context of the festival of dedication, Hanukkah, the Jewish festival of lights. But Hanukkah is much more than a festival of lights. It's about a recall of failure, the failure of previous shepherds in the second century. It's a time when people remember the Maccabean revolution and the time when the authorities are overthrown and the temple is rededicated and reconsecrated. There's a strong link between Hanukkah and the disruption of an old order and the imposition or the bringing in of a new order. An order that will bring a rededication and a renewal and a restoration. Scholars will tell you that during the festival of Hanukkah, there's a worship liturgy, a set program which you read and you follow to celebrate the Festival of Lights. And part of that liturgy, surprise, surprise, is the reading of Ezekiel 34. But there's more here. There's more than a simple critique of spiritual leadership of a nation. Because by setting the conversation in the context of the festival of dedication of Hanukkah, John calls to mind not just failure, but how disruption of that failure can bring about renewal and restoration. It's a reminder of the initial dedication of the first temple under Solomon, of how the priests and the Levites had been there at the initial dedication, and then gradually things had shifted and people had gradually been led away until eventually the nation had become so corrupt that under the Babylonians, the nation was invaded by the Babylonians. The temple was destroyed, Jerusalem was sacked, and they were carried off in huge number into exile. It's a reminder that after 70 years, God released his people from exile, and as a result, and the temple was rebuilt under Joshua, son of Jehozadak, Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah in the 6th century BC, only to be desecrated again by Antoninus Epiphanes in 167, and cleansed again during the Maccabean Revolution in 164. Setting this in the context of Hanukkah, John wants us to see there's something about when we become complacent, when we get into a rut, God disrupts, and he disrupts to bring about a renewal and a restoration. And because of the sort of ministry I have, I move around quite a lot, and whenever I'm interviewed for the post of minister or interim minister, I always try and find out how long the deacons have been in place. And I'm always delighted to discover that the church I'm talking to has a constitution that says after so many terms, the deacons have to step down and have a year off, a sort of a sabbatical type break. But it always worries me when someone shakes my hand and says, hello, I'm so-and-so, I've been a deacon here for more than 50 years. My heart sinks, and I'm sorry to admit it. The first thing that ever goes through my mind is, well, that's where the problem lies then. And the reason is, no matter how servant-hearted we are, no matter how insightful we are, no matter how committed to the well-being of the church we are, over time, the nature of leadership and our own human sinfulness erodes our servant nature, erodes our insights, erodes our commitment, and we get into a rut. And we end up moving from being an asset to the church and its ongoing ministry to becoming something that actually acts as a blockage, stifles the way new ideas, fresh ways of seeing God at work in our world. There's nothing personal in this. It's just sadly part of what it is to be human. Therefore, being part of the church recognizes that there's going to be times where Jesus needs to disrupt. He steps in and disrupts us so that we can gain a fresh view of his mission and ministry at this time and this place in this context. And this conversation in John 22 to 30 is one of those disruptive moments. He signs it with the backdrop leading into chapter 10. He signs it by signposts it by putting it in, setting it in the context of Hanukkah, the service of dedication. He signs it, signposts it, by placing the conversation in Solomon's colonnade, Solomon's portico. This is a place that by the time John gets to write his gospel has become known as a place of disruption where the people of God meet. In Acts 3, we find Peter and John in Solomon's colonnade, and the man that they've met and healed leading into the temple is clinging on to them and telling everybody what a wonderful thing God has done in the name of Jesus. And we find Peter and John taking the opportunity to stand up and to announce the gospel to those who would listen. In Acts 5, we find the believers meeting together in Solomon's colonnade, and Luke tells a story of the miracles that are happening, that the apostles were performing, and how Peter's shadow was enough to bring healing in that place. We read about how they shared all their belongings together and what an impact they made on the community. By the time John gets to write his gospel, Solomon's colonnade has become associated with teaching, with the disruption of God's people meeting together as they share their lives with one another and encourage one another to be faithful in their following of Jesus. And I wonder how our meeting together in this building in Cambridge is disruptive. I wonder what happens that disrupts faith here. I wonder what happens that disrupts status quo here, where our worship, our affirmation of faith, our generosity, how is that disruptive? I wonder. If John sets this context, this conversation in a context of disruption, he hints at the link between disruption, renewal, and restoration in the conversation that follows, which is dynamite. For Jesus, it has the potential to be life-threatening, or at least that seems to be the intention. Because to get Jesus to say, to confirm that he is the Messiah in the presence of all these witnesses, is to sign his death warrant. But there's something interesting here, because scholars will tell you that translating the phrase that is translated in the New International Version, how long will you keep us in suspense, actually is virtually impossible, because the reason is what it actually says is, how long will you keep taking away our lives? It's almost as if the people are saying, we need to know who you are, because not knowing is killing us. There's something disruptive about not knowing. Something about suspense that creates anxiety, that eats away at us, that causes us to become suspended. Something about anxiety of not knowing that can suspend our lives to the point that we seem to actually exist in a living death. Commenting in a podcast earlier this week, a Russian woman whose husband had been taken prisoner in Ukraine speaks of her concern for him, her worry over not knowing whether he's alive or dead, and she describes her life as being over. She has died while she waits for news. There's something about not knowing that disrupts our lives and holds us in a state of suspense. And here in the conversation, the people's not knowing is proving disruptive. But of course, according to Jesus, they already know the answer. They may be asking him to speak plainly, but Jesus' answer to them is, I've told you, and you do not believe. You have not believed. I've shown you the things I do reflect who I am, and yet you don't see it. There's a resonance here with Luke's time in Luke 7 when Jesus is visited by some of the disciples of John, and they come and ask him, "Are you the Messiah, or should we wait for somebody else?" And Jesus quite simply replies, "Go back and tell, report to John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and good news is proclaimed to the poor." For Jesus, these people who are pressing him to reveal who he is have enough information in front of them. They've heard him speak on a number of occasions. They've heard him describe himself in terms like the Son of Man, which has an association with the coming Messiah. They've seen him heal the sick, drive out demons, feed the hungry. And yet they do not understand who he is. I'm not sure what the origins are, but there's a saying that goes, "There are none so blind as those who do not want to see." And I wonder whether these people Jesus is talking to don't want to see, because to see and accept who Jesus is too disruptive to face. I wonder if they were to accept Jesus who they were, they would just find life disrupted. To turn and accept and to believe is to have our lives disrupted. What they might say, it's killing them not to know who he is. My guess is that actually knowing would be equally as difficult for them. As I've already mentioned, I move around between churches quite a lot. And one of the privileges for that is that I get to read a lot of church profiles. I get a lot to see what churches say about themselves. Apart from the fact that I've yet to see a profile that describes the church as a grumpy place, every church profile begins by saying that we are a warm, welcoming fellowship. Apart from that, I'm always struck by the fact that a number of churches say, "We want a minister to come and help us change." And I smile, because the truth is, they probably don't. The truth is, whilst they use the words, to engage in the change that is necessary will become so disruptive that those who say, "Oh, we want change," actually would find it too uncomfortable to be there anymore. It's this discontinuity, this disruptiveness of change that often brings about the difficulty between of a relationship between a minister and their congregation. And as I say that, I'm reminded of the case of Mr. Walker. Mr. Walker was called to be minister of Newton Abbot Baptist Church in 1860. When he arrives at the church is already in a bit of a turmoil. When it opened in 1811, something like that, it opened with a closed communion table. And then they opened the communion table because they had so many people coming. And then someone piped up and said, no, we're a closed communion church. So they closed the communion table, only for a year or two later, them to open the communion table again, and then close it again. And Mr. Walker got fed up with this. When he came, he read the history, and he said, "Look, we really have to sort this out. We really have to decide one thing or another. We're either an open communion table or a closed communion table." And as soon as they said that, they sacked him. Sometimes, while we know what we should be doing, we simply cannot face the disruption that making the decision means. And so rather than face the decision, we claim we don't know what we're supposed to be doing. And while Jesus' initial response is to say that you know what you should be doing, you know who I am, I've told you and I've shown you who I am, there's a second part to his answer. And that second part is that those who have heard and have believed and have embraced who Jesus is have been willing to face that disruption. And because of that, in this closing conversation, we find Jesus returning to the theme of the Good Shepherd. We find him calling to mind the well-known scene of the shepherd leading his sheep from a difficult place, from one place through a difficult situation into a new place of blessing. We find a resonance with that sense of the psalm we opened with, Psalm 23, that begins by still waters, leads to the place of the deepest shadows, sometimes referred to as the shadow of death, and comes out the other side to the banqueting hall of the Lord. The psalmist's affirmation and the psalmist's final affirmation that we will dwell in the place of the Lord forever. Jesus refers to the good, to his people are safe with him. He is the one who holds them, that nobody can snatch them from his hand. However bumpy it gets, however disruptive it gets, we are safe in Jesus. I don't know if you've ever flown in a large airliner. If you have, you will know that there are times when it gets a little bumpy. In fact, sometimes it gets very bumpy. And it may be scary. But the reality is that air turbulence presents very little in the way of danger for large airliners. For smaller aircraft, it's different. But for large, wide-body airliners, turbulence might be uncomfortable, but it's not serious. Here in the conversation, Jesus reminds those who are listening that those who embrace him as the Lord, as the Messiah, will be kept safe. The disruption that they may encounter on the journey may be uncomfortable. It may at times be quite severe, but ultimately they are kept safe. After all, Jesus says, "My sheep listen to my voice and I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life and they shall never perish. No one will snatch them from my hand. My Father has given them to me and is greater than all. No one can snatch them out of my Father's hand." The disruption is uncomfortable, but it should not be fatal. Whether we like it or not, disruption is part of life. It's part of our day-to-day lives. It's part of our lives together as a church. And in that respect, our lives together, the disruption we face is almost always unsettling. But it's often necessary. Because it is through disruption that Jesus brings is able to shake us out of our complacency, to help us to refocus, keeping close to him, helps us to shake us out of the rut that we have chosen to travel. And he sets us off in a new direction. However, having said that, I know that the disruption is unsettling. It's unnerving. Scary at times. But I wonder if we were able to embrace the disruption that Jesus brings, welcome it even though it might be difficult, welcome it because it is a sign of renewal and restoration, but remembering no matter how bumpy it gets, we are safe in Jesus. Safe because Jesus has promised that no power can take us from his grasp. His presence, his love. I wonder if we might find actually the disruptive times as the times we find new direction, new creativity, new life. I wonder as we move forward as a church whether we might find the times of disruption are actually incredibly positive times because they are a gift from God that keeps us on our toes and in touch with him, I wonder. Amen.